Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 167. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing two movies from the middle of the 1950s, both starring the same actor, both directed by that one actor, an Academy Award winning actor who does deserve a lot more kudos than we give him. And those two movies are The Shrike from 1955 and The Great Man from 1956. They both star Jose Ferrer, who'd also directed them, and who won an Academy Award in 1950 for Cyrano de Bergerac as Best Actor. They're both about moral dilemmas in the middle of the 1950s. One's about the way marriages are and how people with mental health are looked after, and the other is about the integrity of a journalist. Both of them have some fantastic acting in them, and they deserve to be remembered a lot better than they are. So sit back, I'm going to get the contact details out of the way now, and after that, we're going to start talking movies. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of classic movie appreciation. There are only two rules to the podcast. The first one is that I have to like the film, or it's been suggested by a Patreon subscriber. The other rule is that it has to be at least 20 years old. So none of this new stuff, it's all old, it's all good. So if you want to contact me, you can email at cultguru@gmail.com, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com, or else you can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also go to paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Now, there occasionally are adult themes and adult language used in this podcast. Just be aware of that as well. You can also leave reviews on iTunes, so if you're so inclined, please do so. It would help the podcast out a lot. So sit back, relax now, and we'll get on with the show. And thank you for listening. Hey, how's everybody going? Yeah, things are fine here. The weather's still pretty shit because it's winter, of course, but there are good movies to watch. There's good movies to talk about. The coffee here is very good, and that's all I really need. I'm a man of simple pleasures. So, so we're going to talk about a couple of movies that are forgotten and that are a little hard to access, one of which you can get in 10 parts on YouTube, and the other one you've really got to scramble around to get. So I'm sorry about that, but I think these movies are interesting enough to talk about them anyway, and you can add them to a list, and when they do become available or when they do cross your radar, you can grab them and enjoy them. And the first one, of course, is The Shrike from 1955, directed by Jose Ferrer, and starring Jose Ferrer and June Allison. And the second one is a better movie from my point of view, and I'll explain why later, which is The Great Man from 1956, which has a very good cast. It's got Jose Ferrer, it's got Julie London in it, it's got Keenan Wynn, it's got Ed Wynn, it's got Jim Backus in it. It's got a great ensemble cast, and it kind of, both of them, in a way, are about themes that are still relevant in the 21st century, which is kind of nice. But one's about journalistic integrity, and the other one is about how people with mental illness are handled. And the way marriages have to be negotiated at times. So they're timely, they're not enormous themes. It's not like aliens are coming to invade from another planet and how are we going to save the Earth kind of stuff. They're about moral dilemmas, they're about complexity, they're about society, and they do it very, very well. But anyway, to start things off, I'm going to start it off, as I normally do, with what movies have I been watching. Now, I did watch a movie from 1997, which is pretty shit. I'll be honest with you. It was on Netflix, hadn't seen it for a decade or more, so I thought I'd watch it, and that's Spawn, the movie from 1997, which was the last movie Nicole Williamson ever made, and it's not really a good reflection of his career. Yeah, it's about a black soldier, black ops soldier, who goes to hell, becomes a kind of soldier in hell, and then escapes to Earth and has all sorts of magical shit to work with, and it's trying to beat up villains, and it's got the worst CGI devil in movie history. But, I'm not going to talk about that anymore. It wasn't very good. I did rewatch John Dies at the End, which is a bit of a mindfuck of a small indie film from a couple of years ago, which has got some really nice drug-influenced scenes. It's got a really fucked-up alternate universe. Some interesting characters. It's got a drug called soy sauce, which does weird things to your head. And if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to do any spoilers on it, apart from that, to say that if you're in the right headspace, it's not a bad little film to watch. I did watch a movie based on a bunch of stories that I read when I was younger, which is Solomon Kane from about 2008, I think it is. And it stars James Purefoy as Solomon Kane, and Pete Postlethwaite's in there as well. It's set during the 1600s, and it's a story of a Puritan who basically fights demons. And it's got a kind of gritty, rain-soaked, pre-Reformation, pre-Enlightenment viewpoint. It's got a great period feel about it, and it's got a really nice CG monster at the end, which kind of works nicely. Some good acting in it, some good sword fighting, and some good action scenes, and all sorts of stuff like that. Really nice little film. It's better than it needed to be what it was. And I did enjoy rewatching that one because I like the Robert E. Howard, Solomon Kane stories. And this is a pretty good adaptation of them, in fact. It really does have some chops to it, and it is a worthwhile piece of work. Now, that was for the radio gig, the ABC Local Radio Northern Territory gig. It was Paul Serratore's turn to have a chat with me because Liz was off doing something else, and Paul, who is in Alice Springs, dead smack in the middle of Australia, was doing ABC Local Radio for the Northern Territory that night. So we decided, as we always do, to find a cult movie to do together, something a little more blokey than the stuff that I do with Liz. And we went with the original 1987 RoboCop, which was kind of fun to revisit and look at. Paul watched it with his partner, and she's not into that sort of film normally, but she really enjoyed it, which is always a good indication. So we talked Peter Weller, we talked the kind of design of RoboCop and how it was influenced by Japanese anime. Had a really good 20-25 minute chat about it, and just kind of went with it. We talked about how the gore in particularly films like RoboCop from the late 1980s tend to have the same consistency as snot, and for some reason blood and guts all were kind of snot thick even when they were just blood. So it was a really weird kind of conversation, but we had fun with it. And we kind of went there and just enjoyed ourselves more than a little bit on it. So I then went and watched RoboCop 3. I'd seen RoboCop 2 about a year ago, maybe. So rather than watch that, I watched RoboCop 3, which is a much lesser one. It was directed by Fred Decker. Much lesser piece of work, even though part of the script was written by Frank Miller of comic book fame. But it wasn't too bad either. I kind of enjoyed it, even though it was a PG-rated RoboCop. I didn't find it totally offensive, and so I watched that. Then I went on to watch one of my vulgar pleasures, which is Blake Edwards' 1980, I think it is, movie SOB, starring Julie Andrews, William Holden in his last role. It's got Robert Webber in it, Robert Preston, a whole bunch of other people. Robert Bourne. It's got a lot of Roberts in it. It's about, you know, a kind of movie director who goes insane after he has a flop and then tries to remake his film. And to this day, it's the only movie that we really get to see Julie Andrews' tits in. But apart from that, I like it. I kind of like the best bits for me are you've got William Holden, you've got Robert Webber, and you've got Robert Preston just sitting around chatting with each other, and they've got some really funny dialogue, and they're old friends whose friend Felix Farmer, played by Robert Mulligan, sees a lot of Roberts, has gone insane, and they're talking about what to do about it, and they're his only true friends, and it's a kind of Hollywood in-joke kind of story, but I like it. It's a little bit of fun and kind of cool. And, it is a bit sad that it was William Holden's last film. But he's still got that charm and got that kind of comfortable way of working where he's in character. He's very smooth. He makes it look easy. And it was good to see that for one last time. What else did I see? I did see a small-ish action film from not too long ago, from a year or two ago, called The Prince, which stars Jason Patrick, Bruce Willis, and John Cusack. It's about a former kind of mafia assassin kind of guy, played by Jason Patrick, whose daughter is kidnapped by drug dealers and who has to go back and get her. Now, he's got history with the Bruce Willis character and with the John Cusack character, but it's not too bad. I mean, it's not a bad action film. It's got a lot of shooting out bullets in the lobbies of hotels and all that kind of thing, and a lot of that kind of action. But, yeah, not too bad. Not good, not bad, but just kind of a nice little actioner if you're in the mood for that kind of thing. Not really as strong as it could have been, but I think the budget was the big limitation there. But nonetheless, I did see it because I was in the mood for something with a bit of bang-bang in it. And that filled the void there. Then I saw a documentary. The last thing I'm going to talk about is a documentary I saw, which was on Netflix, and it is The Lost Soul, The Damned Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau, which was about the making of the Island of Dr. Moreau up in North Queensland with Richard Stanley, who is a director who basically is a drug fight lunatic. And they spent a hell of a lot of New Line's money to make this film. They had Marlon Brando acting really bug-fuck late-era Marlon Brando in there. They had Val Kilmer as one of the other guys, and Val Kilmer acted like bug-fuck mid-career Val Kilmer. They had weather problems. They were off up near Cape Tribulation, which is probably one of the worst places to make a movie for the transport limitations of being up in that part of the Daintree rainforest. But it's a nice documentary just showing what can go wrong in a film if you just get the wrong people working together and the communication lines are not what they could be. And I think it's an honest look at the making of the Island of Dr. Moreau. They also had some problems with John Frankenheimer when he came on board with the project because he's an old school Hollywood director who doesn't take shit from anybody, and that kind of rubbed some people up the wrong way, and there were all sorts of problems there. But they eventually got a movie out, and it lost money, but it didn't lose as much money as they would have lost had they cancelled the movie entirely. But if you're into the kind of history of making movies, this is a good one to watch. It really is a bit of fun, and it is on Netflix in Australia. I don't know whether it's on Netflix in the US, but I suspect it would be. And yeah, it's worth checking out. So that's about it from what I've been watching. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to do these, as usual, in chronological order. And we're going to look at the Jose Ferrer / June Ellison movie, The Shrike, from 1955. The Shrike is a 1955 drama film starring Jose Ferrer and, I just bumped the microphone, June Ellison. It was based on a 1952 play which ran over 100 performances and won a Pulitzer Prize. Don't give those things out for just showing up. You've really got to have some chops. Now, the story's not terribly complicated. It is interesting, and I'll see if I can find a decent pricey for the thing somewhere on the interwebs. Jim Downs, played by Jose Ferrer, was a once successful theatrical producer who has a career failure and is driven to failure by the machinations of his wife, Anne, played by June Ellison. He attempts suicide and ends up in a public mental institution in New York City. And as he's in there and is trying to become well again, it becomes increasingly obvious to Jim that the only way he's going to get out of the asylum is by re-establishing the relationship with his wife and basically giving up, in one sense, any idea of independence and of the kind of life that he wants to lead. He does have a girlfriend with whom he started a relationship during the estrangement with his wife, Charlotte, played by Joy Page. And nonetheless, because of the way society views mental illness and particular depression, he has to kind of work his way through that system in order to leave the mental institution he finds himself in. So that's basically the story of it. The music in the background is actually composed by Jose Ferrer. It's part of the Shrike Suite, which this is the Les Baxter version, by the way. And it'll end fairly soon, so you'll get the melodramatic music out of the way. So basically, this was the first movie that Jose Ferrer ever directed. He had been a stage actor for a long time and had a very, very successful career, including playing the lead role in The Shrike on stage and Broadway. But he left that to pursue a Hollywood career. He did a few other bits and pieces after the great success he had with Cyrano de Bergerac, winning the Best Actor Oscar in 1950. He did a kind of musical version of the life of Sigmund Romberg, a guy who wrote operettas. He made a kind of biopic of that. And then he got the opportunity to do this. He, of course, had a great interest in the play because he'd done it on Broadway. And he had a good relationship with a lot of the cast. In fact, a lot of the cast in the movie, apart from June Allison, are people from the original stage version of it. Now, I'll mention one in particular who was the wife of the person who composed the play, Joseph Cram. And her name is Isabel Bonner. She had a long stage career. She plays one of the doctors, Dr. Barrow, in the movie. And the interesting thing about Isabel Bonner was, as in 1955, the play was still on Broadway, and she was doing a version of the play playing Dr. Barrows. And she was on stage with Dane Clark, who was playing the role of Jim Downs, originally played by Jose Pereira. She's sitting at his bedside, and they've got some dialogue and things like that, and she dropped dead. She dropped dead on stage, playing the role that you see her in this movie. Great tragedy, of course. She was a well-regarded actor. She was only 47. And her husband wrote the play. So there's a weird side note to this particular one. Now, there are some interesting actors in this as well. June Allison was very much playing against type in this movie because people knew her as a kind of cheerful, happy-go-lucky girl in musicals. People kind of knew her mostly for this kind of stuff.
Thou swell, thou witty, thou sweet, thou grand, wouldst kiss me pretty, wouldst hold my hand, for thine eyes are cute to what they do to me. Hear me holler, I choose a sweet lollapalooza in thee.
But she was trying to take her career in other directions. She played Glenn Miller's wife in The Glenn Miller Story with Jimmy Stewart a couple of years before. She did another turn in a movie called Executive Suite, which was probably her first really serious dramatic role, with William Holden and Barbara Stanwyck, and that was well regarded as well. But she was kind of stereotyped as a much lighter player, and to have her come into a movie like The Shrike and basically play the villain of the piece, a woman who, from on the surface of it, and based more on the play, what I know of the play and what I can find out about the play, than the movie, and I'll explain what I mean by that a little bit later. She's one of those people suffering from what is now known as narcissistic personality disorder. She ticks a lot of the boxes for that because I did a little research on that. I've got a friend whose husband, who is a friend of mine as well, suffers from narcissistic personality disorder. And what I see of the Anne character in The Shrike is very much consistent with that. She undermines her husband. She gets him to make bad life choices because she wants to dominate his life and to be in control. She started out with a career as an actor and wasn't very successful at it. And so she then kind of was jealous of her husband's time in the theatre, got herself involved in his work as a theatrical producer and director, and basically did everything she could to undermine him. And then eventually, of course, they lost a lot of their money and they're living under very poor circumstances. And Jim eventually leaves her and goes living in a small, tiny little apartment while he's looking for work. There he meets a girl that he knew a little bit earlier, not biblically, played by Joy Page, who people remember best and most of all for a small role she had in Casablanca. She was the girl who slept with Captain Renault in order to get letters of transit and talked to Rick about that. That's Joy Page. And in this one, it's a kind of a bit of a thankless role. It's very much a secondary role. She plays the girlfriend of a separated man who's not divorced. And in 1950s American cinema, that was very much frowned on. It was not a good look. It was not something that they dealt with in any kind of complex fashion because of the production code and all those censorship restrictions. This movie got skewed from the play. And that's where things get a bit nasty and a bit bad. The ending of this movie is shit. I like a lot of the film. There are some really great scenes in this movie where Jim is in the open ward with the other inmates. And, yeah, they're guys with various problems, none of which we'd see as incurable now. I mean, mostly depression. There's a few people with some personality disorders. There's a violent ward up on the seventh floor, which they all fear going to because it's their idea of hell. But in general, these guys are people suffering from, you know, every day and now very much treatable psychiatric conditions. And that's the interesting thing about seeing this play from a modern viewpoint. Jim basically suffered a breakdown, and it got to the stage where he made a suicide attempt. Now, we all know people have done that. We've all, probably a lot of us, have people in our families that have done that. But in these times, it was seen as something which required hospitalization in all circumstances and over a prolonged period of time. And the way the laws were set out, only the wife could make decisions about the husband's treatment and ultimate release. And the same would be the reverse would be the same for the husband. Not a good look, particularly given the fact that they were estranged and the relationship was a very destructive one for mostly for Jim, but ultimately in some ways for Anne as well. Anne's got more of a safety net than Jim has in this movie. She's got a father in Connecticut or Maine or somewhere like that who owns a business and is willing to give Jim a job and all of that kind of stuff. So she's got an automatic, however far she falls, there's a point below which she can't fall. Whereas Jim didn't have that safety net. When he left in, as a kind of impulse towards survival. And in the movie as well, Jim is played as a man who doesn't really deal well with adversity. He was very successful as a theatrical director and when things were going well and where he was allowed to live that life, he was somebody who would become successful. But he was a man who, when things were twisted by his wife, really didn't have the character in a lot of the film to stand up and say no. He kind of let things, yeah, you know, he didn't want to make a fuss, and in doing so has stymied his own career. And that's that kind of ambiguity. There are ambiguities with both characters in the movie, and in the play it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder film. And some would say, with kind of a little bit of justification, slightly misogynistic, but the character of Anne definitely comes across as somebody who wants to dominate her partner, who can't stand the fact that he would be successful while she wasn't in what she chose to do, and thereby, whether consciously or unconsciously, or maybe instinctively, sabotages his life and his career. And that's very kind of minefield ground to go on too. It can be perceived as misogynistic, but I don't think that was the intention of the play. They do have a number of positive female role models in the movie. One of the psychologists, the one played by Isabel Bonner, is a very sympathetic and professional person. There's a very harsh southern nurse who does the night shift in the ward, who I was thinking was what was about to be set up as the villain. But she kind of is, in a way. She does do something to betray one of the people in the ward by not listening to the other people in the ward. And she had her own ideas about that. But she did. Her name is Miss Wingate, played by Mary Haley Bell. And she's, but on the other hand, she does give information that helps Jim. So she's what? It's nice. It's kind of nice that, because there's a complexity of character there. In one instance, she does entirely the wrong thing and messes up one guy. But she isn't an unsympathetic character. It's just that she was busy and didn't listen and kind of had an instinctive reaction. I've seen people in all sorts of businesses do that and make the wrong decision based on that kind of an approach to things. Yeah, they're flooded under with work. they hear something, they make an instinctive reaction about it and then act upon it. And that's an understandable thing, even though it's not a commendable one. So there are the character actors in the asylum are pretty interesting. Herbie Fay, Martin Benedict, Will Kluver, and Martin Newman being the main ones, and are really interesting characters, and they're given their own life too. They're given their own bits of vitality, and they've given their own little bits of acting to do, which show, I mean, of course, they had the roles down pat. They'd done it hundreds of times on stage. But that then gave the movie version a very lived-in feel, which I kind of like. As soon as they came on the stage, on the scene, they established their characters really well, and we could kind of go with the story as it was happening. And I kind of like that. It gives a verisimilitude and a reality to that particular part of it. And those parts are done almost documentary style. They are well researched about how mental health was handled in New York City in the 1950s. And it's a place where it's done without melodrama. It's done with real drama, but it's done without melodrama. It's not like The Snake Pit or one of those films that are over the top about how mental health issues. It does it very matter-of-factly and very realistically, which is kind of cool, and shows that this movie, apart from that ending, is well worth your time. Jose Ferrer is really good in it as well. You thing to watch too is his body language as different parts of his life. There is a long flashback sequence that shows how he got to where he is. And just watch the body language in all of those kind of scenes, and particularly comparing them to the end scene. There's a lot of kind of nice body acting in this film from that point of view. And a movie that does give sympathy to people with mental illness in 1955, which is, 60 years ago, does have to get a certain level of kudos. Now, I'm going to do a spoiler on the ending and tell you why I think it's majorly the suckage. And this is a fault more with the movie systems of 1955 and the movie studios of 1955 than with Jose Ferrer or June Allison, who are the two characters at the ending. Basically, what Jim decides to do is he decides to go back to his wife so that she will let him get out. Now, he has a conversation with his brother, played by Edward Platt, who people mostly know as playing the chief in Get Smart, but who had a very good career as a character actor. In fact, he's in both of these films that I'm going to talk about this time, and did work again with Jose Ferrer in the 1960s as well. Good character actor, really sympathetic, but also a little bit weak of character playing the brother, and he gives Jim some advice, which is, in a sense, the best advice that can be given him based on the way the circumstances of the film play out. And he tells him, go back and live with Anne, reconcile with her, and tell her that they need to go interstate to go and visit her family, and then leave her, basically use her as an escape route. Do what he needs to do to get out of the mental health facility, because the hard part of the mental health facility is that you're monitored 24 hours a day. You don't have any life. You can't get on with your life at all. And he finds that stifling, and it is ultimately the trigger that lets him make a decision. Now, in the play, that's the end of the film. He gives in and goes back and lives with his wife, not to escape, but because he doesn't want to go stay in a mental institution, so he gives up every dream and ambition. He gives up the alternate life he would have with his girlfriend and caves into Anne. And that's part of the intensity of the drama, the fact that it's a tragedy. Now, the movie doesn't do it the way the play did. The movie has it where Anne comes to the realization of what she's done to Jim, and when they walk out of the facility, she gives him the key to his old apartment, which he's kept going, and tells him that he can go and live his own life, and that she apologizes for everything she did to him in the past. And he then caves in a different way and says, let's try again. And they walk off hand in hand down the street. Now, that kind of defeats the whole purpose of the play, and it's a bit like, I've talked about this in a past podcast when I talked about the movie The Bad Seed. The Bad Seed had a kick-ass ending in the stage play, which Hollywood then fucked. And this is another case of Hollywood fuckage, in the sense that the harder ending was the right one. And it's all in the title. The shrike is actually a bird which eats insects. And what it does with the insects is impales them on a spike to kill them. And the parallel there, of course, is that it's exactly what the Anne character does to her husband. But this being a Hollywood film, the husband and the wife can't separate in it because of the production code at the time. So they tacked on this bullshit ending, which is inconsistent with the rest of the film, inconsistent with the Pulitzer Prize winning play upon which it was based, and doesn't play true to us as an audience. I mean, if Jim did use her as a means of escape, it'd be perfectly justified in the way the film was set up. But it doesn't do that. It doesn't do the bit where he totally caves in and the movie ends in tragedy. It does a Hollywood ending. And that is a real pity, because it really does ruin what would otherwise be a nice piece of drama. Right up to that point, it's a great film. It's got some good acting in it. It says some important things about manipulating people in relationships and about mental health issues. It's got all of that stuff packed in there going for it as a positive force. And then because of the production code, fucked it all. And that's a real sad thing, which is why it's the lesser of these two films in a lot of ways. But right up to that point, it's great. Now, finding this movie is going to be difficult for you. I only found it because I'm on a private tracker, which enables people to share movie files secretly. It's almost a dark web kind of thing, but not quite. But if it turns up on a classic movie channel, see it. If you can find a copy of it anywhere, see it. It's not bad. It really isn't. The ending's bad, but the movie itself is good. Rock solid acting, rock solid storytelling, and important. But anyway, that's about it I'm going to say about The Shrike. But I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to talk about the film that I find most kick-ass of these two, and that is 1956's The Great Man, starring Jose Ferrer. Jim Backus is in it, Keenan Wynn, his father Ed Wynn, and a whole bunch of other character actors. Really nice little film.
Just the color of the sea. And warm, but now the blue I see is more like winter skies with clouds about to storm. Blue is just the color of his eyes. Torch song. ingenues. But now I know, too well I know, too well I know the meaning of the blues.
That is The Meaning of the Blues, sung by Julie London, who sings the same song in The Great Man. It's the only musical number, really, in this particular movie. The Great Man is one of those movies that has a very contemporary theme in some ways. It has parallels with the Bill Cosby stuff at the moment, the Rolf Harris stuff at the moment, the Jimmy Savile stuff. It's not about pedophilia, but it's about a person who is publicly idolized for his entire life, but who ends up being shown as a much meaner, nastier, and phony human being. Now, there were a few movies that did this around that particular time. There was a movie I've talked about in a very early Paleo Cinema podcast, A Face in the Crowd with Andy Griffiths, which does pretty much a similar thing. And there are also other movies like The Big Knife from 1955, which does it in a Hollywood context. But this particular one is about TV and radio. It was based on a novel by Al Morgan, a guy who was on a radio executive for a long time in the 1940s and 1950s. And it is said to be based somewhat on the career of a TV and radio host called Arthur Godfrey, who was loved by millions of people, but who was a real asshole. But the story's, again, fairly simple, but it does bear some similarities to Citizen Kane, where they're investigating the life of a dead great man. And in that, it's a dangerous place to go because you're going to be punching above your weight in any movie that has a similar theme to Citizen Kane. But in the movie, Joe Harris, played by Jose Ferreira, is a local radio news reporter covering Broadway entertainment stuff. And he's the star of his network is a guy called Herb Fuller. He's a big star. He's got a whole bunch of TV and radio shows. He's loved by millions. He's had a career for about 20 odd years. That's been nothing less than stellar. And he works for the Amalgamated Broadcasting Network. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on whose viewpoint you follow, Fuller has a car accident in Connecticut, and Joe Harris, along with Fuller's producer, Sid Moore, played by Keenan Wynn, go down to see how he is and to take care of him. But they get there and find out that he's died in the accident. And there's a great scene where they decide what they're going to do is do some radio stuff using their new technology, being a tape recorder, which is about three times the size of a shoebox in this case, but has a fairly small microphone, which was I found very interesting technically. So they go down there and they want to interview the doctor who treated Herb Fuller before he died. And then we get the first inklings there that things aren't what they seem. And there's a big scene where a whole bunch of studio executives decide that he's going to lie in state and they're going to set up a theatre where people can walk past the coffin. They're going to have eulogies, rolling eulogies from different people, rolling religious services from various denominations and just giving the public a chance to grieve for the great man. And they're going to be doing a big radio show about it. Now, Joe Harris suggests something different, that he does a portrait in sound of the great man's life by interviewing a lot of the people that he knew, people who didn't know him but loved him, and basically doing a kind of hagiography of the man as a radio show. So he's given about a week to do it, and he gets access to all of the people in Fuller's life. And as he progresses through that, interviewing various people, he finds out more and more of the truth of the man's life. And that then becomes a moral quandary for him because he's being groomed to take over this major role of Herb Fuller and take over his TV and his radio shows and to become the new star of the network. He's only known locally in New York and doesn't yet have the profile for the big time. But if he does this right, he will get the chance at the big time. He'll get to do the big brass ring. And therein comes the conflict. He started out as a journalist, Joe Harris, the character played by Jose Ferrer. And his journalistic instincts are re-aroused by the quest to find out the truth about the great man. And so he really feels conflicted about it. You know, does he go for success above integrity? And does he go for the popular bullshit or the honest truth? And therein lies the story, of course. Now, I'm going to play only one clip, even though there are a bunch of them. I'm going to talk about some of the other ones. Interesting. They're all interesting, but you kind of have to pick one. And this one I'm going to pick is with Nick Celentano, played by Jim Backus, an actor who did have some very good roles. I mean, we know him playing Thurston Howell III in Gilligan's Island and any number of other things, including Mr. Magoo. But he did have this kind of career in the middle 1950s where he did a few dramatic roles, and he was good at it. He's in Rebel Without a Cause, and he was in this one, both of which he shows a really great level of talent playing a certain kind of character role. And I love this kind of shit. I love when comedians show that they've got acting chops. I like that kind of fact that some of them have got the talent and the dedication and the want and the urge to do something dramatic. So I'm just going to play the bit where Joe Harris interviews Nick at the start of his quest to find out the truth about the great man.
Oh, yes, here's the official bio on Herb Fuller. This is the
first piece I ever filed. Just don't try and verify any of it.
Nick, I thought I'd go up to Connecticut and get a tape with Fran and the kids.
Well, that's fine. It's a good idea.
What's she like?
Fran? Oh, she's a good kid. She'll give you exactly the kind of tapes that you want.
What kind of a marriage was that, anyway?
Well, you know, Fran liked being Mrs. Herb Fuller, and after the marriage stopped being a marriage, she still wouldn't give him a divorce. She gave him a long leash, though. And as long as nothing got in the paper to jeopardize her place as wife of America's beloved humorist, she was satisfied.
Thought maybe I'd do some tapes with Eddie. Some of the boys in the band, maybe.
Yeah, Eddie in the band. You know, Eddie's one of the few people in the world who really liked Herb. Except, of course, the 150 million members of the Great Unwashed. They adored him.
What about Carol?
Joe. Now, lay off Carol. She's hitting the bottle again, and she's still sore at Herb over that last set, too.
What happened?
But believe me, you couldn't use it on the air. You couldn't even use it on the telephone.
How'd you get mixed up with Fuller in the first place?
Law of supply and demand. I needed a job. He needed a press agent.
Did you like him?
He was the great man, wasn't he?
Didn't you like him?
Well, that wasn't what I was hired for. I just worked for him. 150 million people liked him. One word from him, they'd change their toothpaste, their cigarettes, their shirts, maybe even their politics.
Herb's brand?
No, this is a different brand. Man has to retain a little integrity somewhere along the line. 2 bits for a pack of cigarettes that Fuller doesn't advertise, that's a pretty good buy on the integrity market.
Nick, how do you think I ought to start in on this thing? What do you think I ought to do first?
Well, Joe, I don't think you have any trouble. You've got enough junk in that pile to fill the New York Times from the first page right through to the real estate section. I think you're crazy if you don't bat it out from the clips. The trouble with Fuller is that you're going to sit down and talk to people that knew him. They're going to start talking, and you're going to be fascinated. But you won't hear a thing that you can use in the air. Then all of a sudden, you're going to wake up Friday night at 10 o'clock, and you won't have a show. Just remember that you're doing an obit. And nobody says anything bad about anybody in an obit.
Sorry about the sound quality on that one. But yeah, that's the kind of acting I like. I like a nice character piece. And this movie is chock-a-block full of them. There are some really nice two one-on-one scenes with Jose Ferrer's character. They are done by a number of people. Keenan Wynn does it very well when he talks about a very famous clip of the great man where he's on the front during World War II and talks about what it's like being in a field medical hospital in a little French town during the war. And he does it, it's recorded with the bombs falling in while he's in a medical center. And he talks about how important it is that the guys on the front line get blood plasma to be saved. And it starts a big blood drive back in America so the plasma can be sent to the medical hospitals during the war effort. And that's one of the great things that this particular character, Herb Fuller, has done during his career. It's a very evocative piece of audio. And it's the one redeeming quality of the character. But then Keenan Wynn comes along and his character and talks about the reality behind that particular clip. And so that's one of the great scenes in the movie. The one where Julie London is really good, where she talks about being an 18-year-old kid who gets a chance on Herb's radio show. And basically, as the story progresses, is raped by him and becomes his mistress in order to keep her paycheck coming along. And Julie London was never a strong actor. She's a very beautiful woman, a great singer, but her acting wasn't strong. But the fact that she's not a particularly good actor works well for this character because, in a sense, the character is acting when she's talking to Joe Harris. She's, you know, kind of making an offer to him, in a sense. And it's done by a person who is not a good actor, playing a character who is not a good actor, and he is trying to act. And that kind of makes it work. Those parallels do make it work kind of good. And I keep touching my microphone and the headset, and I shouldn't do that. But anyway, that's another good scene. There's a really good one with Edwin as well, who talks, who plays a character who basically is the first person who gave the great man a job. His name is Paul Beasley, and he runs a small radio station. And Edwin comes in and has a great monologue and then a bit of a dialogue with Jose Ferrer, where he nails it. The acting in it is fucking superb. It's just one of those character pieces that is mind-blowingly good. It really does. This movie is full of great acting moments, and I like that kind of stuff. It's not acting that draws attention to itself. It's not like it was with Jose Ferrer to Cyrano de Bergerac, and he got to leap around and swing swords around and make poems while he was dueling with people. It's not that kind of acting. It's kind of deep character acting, and it's done very well in this film. There's another scene with a guy called Russ Morgan, who used to be a band leader in the 1940s, and he plays Eddie, the character who's mentioned in that clip with Jim Backus, the band leader in the movie. And he has a scene which just nails the kind of self-serving nature of some kind of second-rung celebrities in this kind of an environment. And he does it really well, and it's just a chilling little piece there. And then, of course, we have Edward Platt again playing Dr. O'Connor, the doctor who talks with Joe Harris at the start about how the great man died. And Ed Platt does it really well as well. I mean, there are just so many different good bits in this film. There are some nice little scenes with Ginny, played by Joanne Gilbert, the secretary of Joe Harris, where they have a nice rapport and have a nice kind of friendliness about them, which is one of the threads going through the movie as well. It kind of grounds the Joe Harris character in his work, and even though it's not a particularly big role, it is one that's done really nicely as well. Though there is a moment of sexism with the Joe Harris character right at the start, and once again a little bit later in the film, which kind of, from a 21st century viewpoint, take us away from what should be the viewpoint character just a little bit. But it really can't be helped, and I think it does show the arc of the character to a certain extent, the fact that he's like that at the start of the film, but it's probably not like that at the end of the film, is really maybe part of the story, in a sense. But this film really, you can see it on YouTube, by the way. It is available on YouTube in 10 parts. It's one of those ones that somebody's uploaded a not particularly great copy of in 10 parts to YouTube. And that's how I watched it, because I wanted to see it again. And there aren't any commercially available versions of this movie. I reckon a double DVD Blu-ray set with this and The Shrike together would be kind of cool to have. But that sometimes doesn't happen. And I don't know whether it's ever been available on Netflix in America. Unfortunately, Netflix in Australia is not showing older films at this stage. And that kind of pisses me off, even though there are a number of things on there I like. But both of these movies have a lot to say about them. I mean, the nature of celebrity is an incredibly interesting realm for cinema. As I said, the big Knife Robert Aldridge's movie with Jack Palance does it really well. A Face in the Crowd did it really well. There have been any number of them movies afterwards. Network. There are just so many films about 2 Weeks in Another Town and The Bad and the Beautiful. There are just so many of them that talk about celebrity and talk about the perils and the bullshit that goes along with entertainment industries in a lot of cases, which are kind of really fertile grounds for drama and for showing us really nasty characters, some of whom get to come up and some of whom don't. But either way, they really do have, they're entertaining as all fuck too. These movies are entertaining, and they do parallel things that happen in real life. I mean, the Arthur Godfrey parallel between this movie, Arthur Godfrey's life and career, and also something like A Face in the Crowd. They really do show us the nature of celebrity. And since then, there have been any number of other cases in real life that have done that. And as we increasingly have less and less privacy, these things are going to come up more and more. We've got the Woody Allen thing. We've got the Roman Polanski thing. We've got the Bill Cosby thing. We've got a whole bunch of stuff there where people who are monumentally and uncritically admired for their work turn out to be human beings that disgust us. And we as a culture, or as a number of cultures in fact, don't really have an easy way of negotiating our way through that. We don't really know what to think when somebody whose work and career we really love and admire and really do, it is a part of our past. How we deal with it when we find out that those people are very much assholes. I mean, there's a weird case of it in Melbourne here. There's a burger restaurant called Huxter Burger, which is based on like Clifford Huxtable's preferences on burgers in The Cosby Show. I never watched much of The Cosby Show, so I don't know much about this. But Huxter Burger's got problems now because people aren't going to their restaurant because of the fact that it was based on what it was based on. There's some weird stuff out there. And celebrities are going to be increasingly seen, and politicians as well. There's a lot of political stuff that's pretty disgusting. Now, the politicians tend to have more ability to hide their true natures than do celebrities, mostly because their security is much better. But, I mean, you could even do parallels between Herb Fuller and the most recent celebrity meltdown we know of, which, of course, is Donald Trump. And that same narcissistic personality problem where the real nature of the person becomes obvious to us by their own words and acts. We live in some weird and interesting times. There are lots of wonderful things going on. We're learning new things about ourselves and about the universe. We're learning new things about how to form a civilization and how to destroy one. There's immense amount of information coming our way, and we all have to individually and culturally and collectively work our way through that. And one of them is that kind of odd, idolizing of people who are good at what they do and who are entertainers. The idolizing of entertainers is something that we've done from as long back as there have been cultures. And we really do have to work out what we do when something like that falls on its face and where we find out that somebody with whom we've given our regard and our money and our time has betrayed us. Weird and interesting times we live in, people. But don't let that scare you off watching movies, because, you know, I would have nothing to talk about if that was the case. But that's about it for this time around. These two movies, as I said, are pretty hard to find, but I would love for them to get some kind of a decent release, because I think that they are worthwhile and they are relevant to the world as we see it and live it now. So I did get another Patreon subscriber, so please support the Patreon campaign. Help pay for the podcast hosting. Keep me in microphones and occasional movies to talk about on the podcast. It won't cost you much, and it's better than me going 10 cents a dance on it. I'm actually going to end the podcast. I did put up a Facebook posting on linking to the Patreon subscription to this particular song. But I'm going to play the song, and then we're going to do the Patreon subscriber credits. And as I said, there are a couple of extra subscribers. I still haven't added them to the audio for the credits. But nonetheless, I'd like to thank all of the Patreon subscribers. I will get the credits fixed up for next time. And last time I said that, I did do it too. So I kept the agreement. So I apologize if anybody's credits aren't on the end of the credits for this time around. But I'm going to play the song, which basically says all I need to say about the need for the Patreon campaign and the $1 a month that people may choose to pay to support the podcast. And that, of course, is Doris Day singing 10 Cents a Dance.
$0.10 a dance, that's what they pay me. Gosh, how they weigh me down. $0.10 a dance, dandies and rough guys, tough guys who tear my gown. 7 to midnight, I hear drums. Loudly the saxophone blows. Trumpets are tearing my eardrums. Customers crush my toes. Sometimes I think I found my hero, but it's a queer romance. All that you need is a ticket. Come on, big boy, 10 cents a dance. Fighters and sailors and bow-legged tailors can pay for their tickets and rent me. Butchers and barbers and rats from the harbors are sweethearts my good luck has sent me. Though I've a chorus of elderly beaux, stockings are porous with holes in the toe. I'm here till closing time. Sometimes I think I found my hero, but it's a queer romance. All that you need is a ticket. Come on, big boy, 10 cents a day.
And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Jan, the dialect coach, Armin, the key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, the New York unit director, and Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.